California. Her desktop looked larger than it was because there was almost nothing on it other than a three-panel picture frame, a panel for each of her twin daughters and one for her husband, and a closed manila folder. It wasn't the first time Brian had been in here, staring at a folder just like that one. Zhao's office felt more ominous than he remembered, the air thick with an oppressive potential of career destruction. Maybe he was justified in the shooting of Carlos Smith. Now they knew the would-be shotgun assassin's name. But justified or not, 14 years as a cop hung in the balance. Chief Zhao gestured to two chairs in front of her desk.
Inspector Clouser, Inspector Chang, have a seat, please.
Brian walked to the chair on the right, his eyes never straying from the manila folder. Its edges perfectly paralleled the edges of the desk. It couldn't have been more dead center if Zhao had used a tape measure. Brian sat. So did Pookie. Waves of nausea bubbled in Brian's stomach. He would have to stay focused. His whole body throbbed, but he could deal with that. What he couldn't deal with was losing his breakfast in the office of the chief of police. Robertson nodded at Pookie, then gave Brian a small smile. Was that a good thing? Amy Zhao had held the chief position for 12 years, an infinite tenure by San Francisco standards. While many, many in-house seminars had taught Brian the evils of reacting to a woman's looks, he couldn't deny that Zhao was quite attractive. By the numbers, anyway. Despite being in her late 50s, Pookie said that Zhao would have been officially milfalicious if she ever learned how to smile. She picked up the folder, opened it for a second, then put it down again and straightened it, making sure it was perfectly centered. She already knew the results, obviously. Checking them again seemed more of a nervous tick than anything else. She stared at Brian. He tried to sit still. Chief Zhao left the folder on her desk as she opened it again. This time she leaned forward and read aloud from it.
"Regarding the incident of January 1st, she said, "the use of lethal force against Carlos Smith, a resident of South San Francisco. Preliminary findings indicate that Inspector Brian Clouser acted in a manner appropriate with the situation. Inspector Clouser's actions saved lives."
She closed the folder, straightened it, then stared at him.
"We still have to go through the formal review board, but I can't imagine there will be an issue. Based on the eyewitness accounts I read, I will communicate to the review board my opinion on the situation."
The breath slid out of Brian's lungs. He was off the hook.
"That's great, Chief."
Robertson came around the desk, clapped Brian on the back.
"Come on, Clouser," he said. "You knew this was a righteous shoot."
Brian shrugged, tried to play the part.
"I keep winding up in the wrong place at the wrong time."
Robertson shook his head.
"You did what had to be done, and this isn't the first time. You saved lives. You had no choice."
Zhao turned to Jennifer.
"Miss Wills, any further comments from the DA's office?"
"No, Chief Zhao,"
Jennifer said.
"Considering Smith's record of violence, even the usual San Francisco protester crowd will probably ignore this one. We'll be ready for the inevitable lawsuit from Smith's family, but between the witnesses and the security camera footage, we're in the clear."
Zhao nodded, then turned back to Brian.
"I have some more good news. Steve Boyd investigated the apartment of Joseph Lombardi, also known as Jojo Lombardi. Boyd found evidence to make Lombardi our lead suspect in the Oblomowitz case. We have that name because of you and Pookie."
Brian nodded. Lanza had given up Jojo, true, but it remained to be seen if anyone would ever see Lombardi alive again. Lanza needed someone to go down for the crime, to show the Norteños that blood had been settled with blood. Odds were that Lombardi would turn up dead. The white-haired Sharrow stood.
"Chief Zhao, does Clouser need to be on desk duty while this case is with the shooting review board?"
"No,"
Zhao said.
"This was a clean shoot. Inspector Clouser, you and Inspector Chang will continue to work on the Oblomowitz task force. We need you guys too much right now to put you behind a desk. That's it, people. Get back to it."
He felt so relieved it almost made him forget about his sour, churning stomach. Brian didn't care about Carlos Smith, but he did care about his job. Anything could happen in a shooting review. Ignoring his body's numerous complaints, Brian stood, thanked everyone for their support,
then walked out of Chief Zhao's office, happy to still be a cop. Chapter 16 The White Room. Warm. Toasty warm. Blankets. Soft blankets. Dry blankets. Clean clothes that slid against his skin. Skin that was scrubbed free of dirt and grime and sweat for the first time in months. Aggie rolled over and heard a metallic rattle. He blinked a few times as he woke. Was he wearing pajamas? He flashed back to his childhood bed in Detroit, to his mother gently waking him with loving words and hugs, the smell of pancakes filling the small house. But this place didn't smell like pancakes. It smelled like paint. It smelled like bleach. He was on his side, the blankets bunched up around him, lying on a mattress so thin he could feel the hard floor beneath. The world seemed to move, to wave. But he knew from long experience that was just the horse talking. He opened his eyes and blinked. Yeah, he was still more than a little high. Was this really happening? Just inches from his face was a wall made of broken bricks and rounded stones, all coated with a glaze of bright white enamel so thick the surface must have been painted over and over and over again. Something heavy hung around his neck. Aggie's hand shot up to find a flat metal collar. There was barely enough room to slide a finger between the collar and his neck. But inside, he felt a soft leather strip to cushion the metal against his skin. More metallic rattling. His hands reached behind the collar, found a chain. He sat up, hands pulling the chain around where he could see it. Stainless steel, its chrome-like sheen reflecting fluorescent lights from above. Each quarter-inch thick link showing a tiny, curved reflection of his black skin and shocked face. He looked down the chain's path. It led into a stainless steel ring mounted flat into the white wall.
Oh, shit. Please just let this be a bad trip.
Ayúdenos,
a man said. Aggie turned away from the white wall, toward the voice, and saw a family. Small boy clinging to his mother, mother clinging to him, father with arms protectively wrapped around them both. The woman and the boy looked terrified, while the man stared with eyes that promised death to anyone that came near. Black hair, tan skin, they looked like Mexicans. All three of them wore pajamas, pale blue cotton for the man, fuchsia silk for the woman, pink flannel with blue cartoon puppies for the boy. The clothes looked clean, but well used, the same way clothes looked in the Salvation Army store on Sutter Street. Like Aggie, they all wore stainless steel metal collars with chains leading into holes in the wall. Aggie stood and started walking around slowly, his chain rattling across the stones beneath and behind him.
Por favor, ayúdenos,
the man said.
Ayude a mi familia.
I don't speak Beaner.
Aggie said.
You speak English?
The man shook his head.
No speak.
Figured. Fucking people coming to this country without speaking the language.
What is this place?
Aggie said.
What the hell are we doing here?
The man shook his head.
No entiendo, señor.
Aggie looked around the room. The wall shimmered. Shifted. The smack made it hard to focus. He wasn't sure if he was seeing reality or not, but the circular room looked like it had a curved ceiling, sort of like a dome, about 30 feet across with a high point maybe 15 feet off the floor. The floor looked the same as the walls, rocks and bricks laid down in a rough, flat pattern, repeatedly slathered with enamel paint. Aggie felt like he was inside a big stone igloo. On the far side of the room stood a door of bright white bars, a prison door. 10 mattresses lay on the floor, one for each of the circular rings Aggie counted in the walls. Chains led out of 4 of the rings, connecting to Aggie and the 3 other people. Several loose blankets lay on each mattress. The blankets, like the clothes, had that second-hand look. But everything, from the clothes to the blankets to the mattresses to the walls, looked clean. A 1 foot circular stainless steel flange marked the center of the room's floor. Aggie saw 3 rolls of toilet paper sitting on the flange. Was that where he was supposed to shit? Something really fucked up was going on here, and Aggie wanted out. He might be a bum, might have phoned in all pretense of a real life many years ago, but the significance of being a black man in a collar and chains was not lost on him. The woman started to cry. The little boy looked at her, then started to do the same, and again buried his head in her bosom. The man kept staring at Aggie.
I got no idea what's going on, Aggie said. If you want help, ask someone else.
A metallic noise rang from the walls and echoed through the small room. 3 heads looked around, Aggie, the man and the woman, eyes searching for the source of the sound. The little boy didn't look up. Another clang. Aggie realized it came from the holes in the wall. Then the sound of chains rattling. Aggie's collar yanked him backward. He stumbled and fell, banging his elbow, then choked as the chain dragged him across the hard, bumpy ground. He reached out, hands grabbing for anything, but his fingers found only blankets that offered no resistance. The woman slid across the floor, her hands clutching her child tight to her chest.
Jesús nos ayuda!
The man tried to fight, but the chain dragged him along as easily as it did the woman. The little boy just screamed. The chains pulled him away from his mother. Their arms grabbed at each other, but they were powerless against the steady mechanical force. Aggie felt his back hit the wall, then felt himself pulled up the wall, the collar's edge digging into his lower jaw, pressing against his throat and cutting off his air. He managed to get his feet under him just as the chain pulled the collar against the wall ring, where it clanged home with a metal-on-metal authority. The yanking stopped. Aggie sucked in a deep, panicked breath. He grabbed the collar and tried to lean forward, but the chain wouldn't budge. All 4 prisoners were in the same predicament, collars pulled tight against stainless steel rings. Hands grabbed at necks, feet pushed against white walls, but none of them could move. They all stood there, waiting.
Mama!
The boy screeched, finally finding his voice.
¿Qué está pasando?
No sé,
she said.
Sé valiente. Lo protegeré.
For some reason, Aggie recognized that last bit of Mexican. Be brave. I will protect you. But the mother couldn't do anything. She was as powerless as the boy was. The sound of a big key ratcheting open a metal lock silenced them all. The white prison gate swung out. Was this really happening? Everything seemed to blur. The walls blazed with a white that couldn't possibly exist in the real world.
A bad trip. A bad trip. That's all this is. I'm tripping.
When he saw what walked through the cell door, Aggie's instincts took over. It didn't matter if he was high, dreaming, or stone-cold sober. He pulled harder than he'd ever thought possible. Pulled so hard he almost choked himself out. But still the collar refused to budge. Men in hooded white robes with rope belts tied around their waists. Only they weren't men. They had the faces of monsters. A pig, a wolf, a tiger, a bear, a goblin. Twisted, evil smiles. Beady eyes blinking away. Something primitive and raw inside of Aggie screamed for deliverance. Pigface carried a wooden pole, perhaps just over 10 feet in length. The pole ended in a stainless steel hook. The 5 robe-covered monsters moved slowly toward the boy.
The boy, their child, like my daughter was my child, with her skin as smooth as melted chocolate.
My daughter,
please don't kill my daughter.
The Mexican man screamed with rage. Aggie blinked, shaking away the memories that he'd worked so hard to leave behind. The woman screamed, too, hers one of heart-wrenching fear. Her son mimicked the sound, his all the more hurtful for its high-pitched terror. The boy saw the monsters coming for him. He thrashed like an epileptic, spit and blood dribbling from his mouth, his eyes so wide that even from 15 feet away, Aggie saw the boy's full brown irises. The boy clawed at his collar, his fingernails cutting into his own soft skin. The man continued to shout threats that Aggie didn't understand, protective rage roaring out and echoing off the white walls. The white-robed men ignored him. They stopped a few feet from the boy. One of them produced some kind of remote control and hit a button. The boy's chain loosened. He shot forward, but only made it 4 feet before the chain yanked taut again, and his feet flew out from under him. The boy fell hard on his back. He rolled to his hands and knees, screaming, crying, bleeding, trying to get up. But the five were on him. Black-gloved hands reached out from white sleeves and held him tight. Pigface reached down with a pole and slid the steel hook through the back of the boy's collar. The one with the remote control hit another button. The boy's chain went completely slack and slid free from the hole in the wall. It hit the floor with a cascading rattle, one end still connected to the collar, the other end connected to nothing. Pigface gripped the pole and walked to the door, dragging the boy along behind him. The loose chain trailed along like a dead snake, links ringing against the stone and brick floor. Aggie wanted to wake the fuck up, and wake the fuck up right now. The mother begged. The father roared. The boy's clutching fingers left thin red smears against the white floor. Pigface walked out the door. He turned right and vanished behind a corner. The boy slid out behind him, dragged by the pole. The last sight of him was his chain, pulled out of the room with a final thin ring when it clanged against the open white jail cell door. The other monsters walked out. One by one, they turned the corner and were gone. Goblin Face was the last to leave. He turned and pushed the cell door shut behind him. It clanged home, the metallic sound echoing and fading as the mother's screams went on and on. Chapter 17. Rex Gets in Trouble. Rex sat in the waiting room of St. Francis Hospital, a new cast on his broken right arm. The cast ran from above his elbow down to his hand, wrapping across his palm, leaving his thumb peeking out of a white hole. Stupid thing would be on for at least 4 weeks. A feeling of pure dread hung in his chest and head, dragging his chin down almost to his sternum. The arm had been bad, real bad. But now Roberta was coming. Alex Panos had nothing on Rex's mother. He sniffled back tears. They didn't have money for this. They didn't have insurance. But Alex had broken his arm. What was Rex supposed to do? She came through the doors, saw him immediately, and made a beeline right for him. Roberta, too skinny, nasty, wiry hair that smelled like cigarettes, and that disgusting skin. She stood in front of him. His chin tried to dig itself even deeper into his chest. She stared. He wanted to just die.
"So you were fighting again?"
Rex shook his head no, but even as he did it, he knew better.
"Don't lie to me, boy! Look at your goddamn nose! You were fighting again!"
He felt the tears coming. He hated himself for crying. He hated her for making him cry. He hated Alex for all of it. He hated his life.
"But they attacked me, Mom, and..."
"Don't you call me that!"
Roberta's voice carried through the waiting room of St. Francis, drawing stares from the walking wounded awaiting treatment. She saw the glances, lowered her voice to a nasty hiss.
"You can just stop it right now, Rex! Do you have any idea what this is going to cost me?"
Rex shook his head again. The tears streamed down his face. Roberta huffed and strode over to the billing desk. Rex tried to slink even deeper, but there was nowhere left to go. Roberta and the woman behind the counter exchanged words. Then the woman handed Roberta a bill. Roberta read it. Then she turned to look at him, and the world grew colder. Rex hid his face in his uncasted hand, tears wetting his palms. He rocked back and forth. He didn't want to go with her, but he had no place else to go. He had no one. Chapter 18. Shero Sends Brian Home.
Clouser.
Someone shook his shoulder. Brian tried to say something to the effect of, "Leave me alone or I'll kill you," but all that came out was a three-syllable mumble. Another shake.
Clouser!
Captain Sherrow's voice. Brian blinked awake.
Clouser, this isn't the place for a nap.
Damn. He had fallen asleep at his desk.
Sorry, Captain.
Jesse Sherrow glared down, his white hair and bushy white eyebrows framed his weathered scowl. Brian started to stand up. His butt cleared only 1 inch of airspace before aching muscles and bones froze him in place, then promptly dropped him back down on the chair.
Good God, man,
Sherrow said.
Wipe that drool off your chin, will you?
Brian touched his cheek, cold and slimy. Well, that was certainly a way to score points with your boss. He wiped away the spit. Sherrow pointed to the stack of paper on Brian's desk.
Reprint that.
Spots of drool had soaked into Brian's report.
Sorry,
Brian said.
Go home, Clouser. You're a dumbass coming in here like this, bringing your germs in with you. You want to put the whole department down?
I wasn't planning on making out with anyone, Captain. Except for you, of course.
Blow it out your ass,
Sherrow said.
You're so ugly you make my wife look hot, and that's saying something.
It sure is.
Sherrow snarled and pointed a finger at Brian's face.
Watch it, Clouser. Don't talk bad about my wife.
Yes, Captain. Seriously.
Go home.
But, Cap, I still have paperwork for the shooting review board to...
Shut your pie hole. Get out of here. In fact, don't bother reprinting that report. Just email it to me. I don't want to touch anything that's come anywhere near you. Be out of here in the next 10 minutes.
Sherrow turned and stormed off. Brian hadn't taken a sick day in 4 years, but after falling asleep at his desk, drooling on paperwork, maybe it was for the best if he cleared out. With both hands flat on the desk, he pushed himself to a standing position, every muscle screaming the biological equivalent of horrid obscenities. A crumpled-up $20 bill landed on his desk. Brian looked up. Pookie had thrown it.
Take a cab, Pookie said. I'm not driving you.
Don't want a sick guy in your car?
Pookie let out a pfft noise of disgust.
You've already been in my car. I'm not driving you because you said you'd make out with Sherrow and not me. I have feelings, you know.
Sorry about that.
Pookie shook his head.
Men, you're all pigs. Do I need to call you an ambulance instead of a cab?
No, I'm good.
Brian shuffled out of the office and headed for the elevator. The sooner he got to sleep, in an actual bed, the better. Chapter 19. Robin gets the call. A rare, quiet moment at home. Robin was taking advantage of the time to sit on her couch and do nothing. Nothing but scratch the ear of her dog, Emma. Emma's head rested on Robin's lap. Emma wasn't supposed to be on the couch. She knew that. Robin knew that. Yet neither of them was motivated enough to do anything about it. Robin was home so little these days, she didn't have it in her heart to scold the 65-pound German short-hair pointer for wanting to be closer. Robin slowly swirled the dog's floppy black ear. Emma moaned in happiness with a doggy equivalent of a cat's purr. As Robin's responsibilities grew, so did her time at the morgue. Thankfully, her next-door neighbor, Max Blankenship, could almost always swing over to take care of Emma if Robin worked late. Max would take Emma to his place to play with Billy, Max's gigantic pit bull. Max was sweet, kind, clever, handsome, sexy as hell, and had a key to her apartment. The perfect man, if not for the small fact that Big Max was as gay gets. Robin's cell phone rang. She looked at it, but didn't recognize the incoming number. She thought of ignoring it, but it might be work-related, so she answered.
Hello?
Dr. Robin Hudson?
Asked a woman's voice.
This is she who's calling, please.
Mayor Jason Collins' office. The mayor would like to speak with you. Can you hold for a moment?
Sure.
The phone switched to elevator music. The mayor's office? It was 10 o'clock at night. And more than that, the mayor's office? Why would the mayor be calling her? Because it was the mayor who appointed the chief medical examiner. Oh, no. Had something happened to Dr. Metz? The on-hold music clicked off.
Dr. Hudson.
She'd heard his voice dozens of times on newscasts. This wasn't a prank. Holy shit.
Yes, this is Robin Hudson.
This is Mayor Collins. Sorry to bother you so late at night, Dr. Hudson. Do you prefer to be called Doctor, or can I just call you Robin?
Robin is fine. Is Dr. Metz okay?
Sadly, no.
The mayor said.
Dr. Metz suffered a heart attack earlier this evening. He's at San Francisco General.
My God.
Her heart suddenly pounded at the thought of never seeing her friend again, of death taking him away forever.
Is he going to make it?
They think so,
the mayor said.
He's in stable condition, but he's not out of the woods yet. I'll have my office put you on the notification list. The hospital calls me with any information. I'll be sure to relay that same information right out to you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I assume you understand why I'm calling.
Robin nodded to herself, scratched Emma's ear.
Someone needs to run the medical examiner's office.
That's right. I'm hoping our famous Silver Eagle will make a full recovery. If he isn't able to return to work, we'll launch a nationwide search for a new chief medical examiner. Until we know if he'll be okay, however, can I count on you to run the ship?
Was she ready for this? Could she run the department and not screw it up? There wasn't any time to doubt herself. Metz would expect her to handle things in his absence.
Of course, Robin said. I'll keep everything running smoothly, just the way Dr. Metz likes it.
Excellent. Now, I know this is upsetting news and a lot of information to process, so I'll let you go. I will say that I'm pleased a representative of our active Asian American community is there to take care of things in the interim.
Were she not so shocked and saddened by the news of her mentor's heart attack, Robin might have laughed. Mayor Collins would find a way to spin this into votes. Asians made up a third of San Francisco's voters. He probably didn't know she'd grown up in Canada, the daughter of an immigrant Englishman. Still, she'd inherited her mother's looks, and that meant she'd make a good potential photo op for the mayor. Not that she'd mind taking a picture with a hunk like Collins. With his tailored suits, expensive haircuts, and big-jawed smile, the handsome mayor had topped most eligible bachelor lists for years.
Something else to think on,
he said.
Well, we will, if necessary, do a search for a new chief ME. You're in charge right now. If you want that job long-term someday, this gives you a hell of a leg up.
She was already being considered for the top spot?
Of course, Mr. Mayor.
Just one more thing, Robin. The Paul Maloney case is sensitive, delicate. I know Dr. Metz finished the examination, so I'm having Maloney's body removed from the morgue.
And you're taking it where?
Somewhere safe,
he said.
I'm too worried that, with Maloney's past, victims or relatives of victims might want to desecrate the body.
Someone would try to break into the San Francisco morgue?
Mr. Mayor, I don't think you need to worry about that.
I am worried about it,
he said.
I know the morgue is at the Hall of Justice, but remember that cops are parents, too. With Dr. Metz out of commission for the first time in recent memory, someone might get ideas. I want to remove that temptation. Maloney's body will be gone when you arrive tomorrow morning. Understand?
She didn't understand. At all. The processing of the deceased was done under a strict protocol. But maybe this was how politics worked. At any rate, Jason Collins was the boss, and she wasn't going to rock the boat so soon, not when her future career might be on the line.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, she said. I understand.
Great. Robin, I'm thrilled you ran on this. We'll let you know when Dr. Metz can have visitors. Good night.
Good night,
she said. She hung up and stared at the phone. She stared at it so long that Emma wondered what was going on, thought the phone might be a treat, so she stared at it as well. Robin put the phone down, then scooched both of Emma's ears. The dog's eyes narrowed sleepily, and she growl-moaned with pure love.
"Hear that, baby girl?"
Robin said.
"I'm sorry, but it looks like you might be seeing more of your Uncle Max. A lot more."
Chapter 20. Hunter's Blind. Like any good hunter, Brian waited. He didn't know how he'd come to be here, but he recognized the place. He was on Post Street, his back to an abandoned boarded-up laundromat at the corner of a little alley called Meacham Place. A gate of square, 10-foot-high black bars blocked the entrance to the alley. Beyond those bars, he would take his prey. Covered by a damp, smelly blanket, he lay perfectly still. Streetlights lit up most of the concrete sidewalk, but couldn't chase away all of the darkness. Shadows flexed and moved in time with the passing of late-night cars and taxis. The blanket covered every inch of his body, everything except for a narrow slit through which he could watch. People ignored his presence, and why not? Just one more nasty-ass bum sleeping on the streets, an everyday sight in San Francisco. People walked past, only a few feet away, oblivious to the concept that death hid beneath tattered, filthy third-hand fabric. Many times on nights just like these, he had grabbed such people and dragged them into the darkness. He waited for the boy with the curly black hair.
Hail to the king.
First had come the visions. Visions of hateful faces, tastes of fear and the flush of humiliation, of helplessness. Waking dreams made Brian feel what it was like to be bullied by a pack of boys, to be beaten by a woman who should have protected, to be violated by a man who promised love. All of those people had wronged the king. All of those people had to be punished. How dare they hurt him? How dare they? Brian and the others searched, they watched, they hunted, until the faces of dreams matched faces of flesh and blood. The priest had been first. He could only die once, so they had made it last. Now the bullies would pay the same price. Brian wanted the blonde boy, the leader, but he was hard to find. He was difficult game. The curly-haired boy, though, he was predictable. He often came this way. It would not be enough to just take the curly-haired boy away, to make him disappear. There was too much rage for that, too much anguish. Like with the priest, the world had to know.
Hail to the king.
The curly-haired boy turned the corner. Brian stayed calm, stayed motionless inside his hunting blind, moving nothing except his eyes. Brian wasn't the smartest, he knew that, but he could hunt like no one else. As big as he was, the prey never saw him coming. The boy walked down the sidewalk like he owned the whole street, his turf, his neighborhood, his territory. Big enough that most would avoid him, young enough to think he controlled his life, to think that no one wanted to mess with him.
One womb.
The heat of the hunt boiled inside Brian's skin, a feeling so primitive it bordered on lust. Brian wanted to kill, needed to kill. The black curly hair stuck out beneath the boy's white baseball hat. He wore a dark crimson jacket with the big, angled letters BC on the left chest. An eagle, forever paused with wings back and talons outstretched, sat in the middle of those letters. The boy drew closer. Brian breathed slowly. The boy glanced at Brian's blind, then wrinkled his nose and looked away. The boy drew even with Brian, took two steps past. Then came the voice.
Help me.
That voice came from behind the black gate. The boy stopped, looked through the gate's bars into Meacham Place's still shadows. Brian knew what the boy would see. On the right, scraggly 10-foot-tall trees growing up out of the narrow sidewalk, trunks only a foot from a brick wall, their leaves casting down lightless pools of deep black. On the left, the laundromat's crumbling masonry, broken windows and layers of graffiti. And in the middle, lying on the cracked pavement, a bearded man in a white tank top. Brian waited. There were enough cars passing by that if the boy ran, Brian would have to let him go. If the boy went into the alley, Brian and the others would move.
Take the bait.
The boy looked down into his left, again examining Brian's blind, again deciding the unmoving blanket-covered homeless person wasn't worth worrying about. The man in the alley called out a second time,
so softly that no one but the boy would hear.
Help me, please. I'm hurt.
Take the bait.
The boy gripped the gate's black bars. He quietly climbed over, careful to avoid the pointy spear tops, and dropped down on the other side. Brian moved without a sound, turning his head slightly to look down Post Street, empty enough to act. He quietly stood, but remained hunched over. Brian was careful to keep the big blanket looped around his face, like a hood, so that no one could see what was underneath. The rancid fabric cut off his peripheral vision, but that didn't matter. It was almost over. A crawl of fear washed over him. The monster was always out there, somewhere. Brian looked up, scanned the buildings above, looking for movement, for an outline. Nothing. He had to draw the symbol, and soon, or the monster would come for him.
Mister,
he heard the boy say.
You okay?
Was the boy going to try and help, or was he just looking for an easy victim? It didn't matter. Brian bent slightly, then jumped. He sailed over the gate and came down silently on the other side.
One womb, one family.
The man in the white tank top lay on the ground, his beer gut spilling out from under the shirt and over his dirty jeans. He wore a green John Deere ball cap. He reached up a chubby hand toward the boy who stood a few feet away.
Help me, please.
Marco was a good actor, really good. The boy moved closer.
You got any money, asshole?
The heat of the hunt bubbled Brian's soul. He took a step toward the prey. When he did, his foot ground a small rock against the asphalt, making a slight skrit sound that caused the curly-haired boy to turn. Brian smelled fear. The boy realized he'd made a mistake. He was cut off, trapped between two men. His hands clenched into fists, his eyes narrowed, and his head dipped down a little, as if he might lash out at any second. Like most trapped animals, the boy growled a warning.
Fuck off, he said to Brian. Don't fuck with me, you piece of shit bum.
Behind the boy, Marco silently rose to his feet. Brian finally stood tall and let the filthy blankets drop to the ground. The boy's face changed. The haughty look slowly slipped away, his angry, icy stare melting into puzzlement. He took a step back, right into Marco's belly. The boy turned, found himself face to face with Marco. It was hard to see anything under that beard, but Brian knew Marco was smiling. Marco reached behind his back. When his hand came out again, it held a rust-spotted hatchet. The alley's feeble light flickered off the sharpened edge.
Don't,
the boy said. He didn't sound that tough anymore. Brian heard the flap of fabric, of things falling from above. The others landed on either side of the boy. One remained tucked under a dark blanket, his face hidden save for the glint of a yellow eye. The other let the blanket slide free. Brian saw a nightmare. A man with purple skin, with big black eyes. It stared at the boy for a moment, then smiled wide, a mouth full of big, white, triangular teeth. The one still hidden inside a blanket spoke.
Pierre,
he said, in a voice that sounded like sandpaper on rough wood.
This one is yours. Take him.
Sly had kept his promise.
Hail to the king, motherfucker.
Brian rushed in. He took the bully from behind, teeth sinking into the prey's shoulder. Brian's mouth filled with the vibrations of crunching bone, the nylon taste of the crimson jacket, and the sweet heat of squirting blood. Brian opened his eyes. His heart mule-kicked in his chest. Adrenaline pumped cactus prickle through his veins and muscles and skin. His pulse blasted away, undeniable in one place more than any other. He sat on the edge of the bed, staring off into the dark room, his rock-hard erection pitching a tent in his underwear.
The dream had gone farther than the last. Brian hadn't just stalked. He'd attacked. He had tasted blood. He could still taste it. So why was he vibrating with excitement when he should be vomiting in disgust? Why did he have a boner so hard a cat couldn't scratch it? And why did he feel like he was being watched by someone who wanted to kill him?
What the fuck is wrong with me?
No one answered, because there was no one else in the room. There was never anyone else. He was alone in his silent apartment, as he had been every day since he'd moved out of Robin's place. He reached over to his nightstand to grab the pen and the notebook he'd left there. He drew a few scraggly lines. He didn't even know what it was, only that it wasn't quite right. Still that feeling, that being watched feeling, it faded away. Brian let out a long, deep breath, then set the pad and pen back on the nightstand. He stared at it for a moment, then picked it up again and wrote down two words. Meacham Place. He set the pad down a second time, then snuck a peek in his underwear. Boner diffused. He felt better, but there was no point in trying to go back to sleep. He could still taste the kid's hot blood in his mouth. And it tasted good. He pulled the bed's comforter tight around his shoulders and stumbled to the living room, feeling a sudden urge to watch Creature Features on cable. Chapter 21 Pleasant Dreams. Rex woke suddenly, sat straight up in bed. His chest heaved. His face dripped with sweat that cooled in the night air. In the dream, Rex hadn't feared Oscar. Oscar had feared Rex. Then the grabbing, the biting, and that taste. The taste of blood. Rex pushed back the damp covers. The air cooled his sweaty skin. It also cooled a spot down there. He looked to his bedroom door. It was closed. He looked at the clock. 3:14 a.m. Roberta would be asleep. He pushed the covers down past his legs. In the alarm clock's faint red light, he saw a darker spot on his underwear. Rex reached down and touched. Wet. He looked at the door again. In his sleep, he had done the bad thing, the naughty thing. Would she find out? If she did, she would beat him. Rex started to shake. He slid the underwear off, then stuffed them in the bottom of his book bag. He grabbed 3 sheets of Kleenex and cleaned himself up, eyes constantly flicking to the door. He put on a fresh pair of underwear. So weird that he dreamed about Oscar. Rex quietly walked to his desk. A streetlight outside his window cast a dim glow on his most recent drawing, a pencil sketch of Rex using a sledgehammer to crush the skull of Oscar Woody. How he wished that was reality, that he could strike back at them, make them pay. But drawings and dreams weren't real life. Rex felt tears welling up in his eyes. He grabbed the paper, crumpled it into a ball, and threw it in the trash. He then crawled back into bed, his sheet still wet with his own sweat. Rex threw his head down on the pillow and pulled the covers up tight. His eyes squeezed shut, shaking and alone. He cried. Chapter 22 Brian Clauser, Morning Person. The brown Buick cut across 3 lanes of traffic. Brian covered his face, trying to ignore the chorus of horns sounding in the car's wake.
Jesus, Pooks, try not to kill me before we go back on nights, will you?
Pussy, Pookie said. Hey, I have some more ideas on our series Bible.
It's your TV show, Pooks, not ours. I'm not writing anything.
You're an executive producer, Pookie said. No one knows what the hell executive producers do anyway. Here's my idea. We make the chief's wife this smoking hot MILF. She's ignored by her work-obsessed husband, so to fulfill her need to feel sexy and wanted, she uses her feminine wiles to tease the young rebel detectives. But it backfires on her when the good-looking detective, based on me, of course, finally beds her with the Chang-Bang.
Brian couldn't help but laugh. The Chang-Bang was from Pookie's previous pet project, a coffee table book called 69 Sex Positions the Kama Sutra Forgot.
Is the Chang-Bang the one with the trapeze?
No, the trapeze is only used in Granger's Golden Snitch. The Changbang is the one with the hula hoop and the semi-inverted angle on the bar stool.
Brian sighed and looked out the window.
The hula hoop. How could I forget?
Anyway, we checkmark yes for hot scene, but we also get ongoing dramatic tension as our one-night fling turns into a torrent love affair.
Torrid.
What?
Torrid, not torrent.
That too, Pookie said. The staff sergeant with the heart of gold finds out and tries to give wisdom to the young rebel detective. And it makes things dicey between young rebel detective and his nemesis, the crotchety old guard chief of police.
Your show seems to be more about sex than police work, Brian said. You getting laid these days?
Pookie shook his head.
Nope. I put Junior and the twins into a hiatus while I work on the series Bible.
Well, then maybe you should lay off the torrid scenes for a while or you're going to wind up with blue balls.
Pookie's head snapped to the right. He stared at Brian. The car swerved into the left lane. Brian pointed at an oncoming truck.
Dude!
Pookie saw the truck, slammed the Buick back into the proper lane as the truck shot by, horn blaring.
Pooks, what the fuck?
Sorry, he said. But that's it. You did it!
I did what?
Came up with a name.
Of?
Of the TV show,
Pookie said.
You know, the thing we've been talking about for the past 15 minutes?
And that name is?
Blue Balls!
It would have been a good joke, but the man looked serious.
Pooks, you're going to name your TV show Blue Balls?
Pookie nodded.
You can't name a show Blue Balls.
Like hell I can't, he said. Half cop drama, half softcore porn. Just think of all the classic TV shows that have lasted more than three seasons, which puts them into syndication, where the big bucks are, by the way, that have the word blue in the title. Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue, Blue Bloods, Rookie Blue.
Those are cop terms,
Brian said.
Blue Balls has, like, a totally different meaning.
Right. It's sexier. That means HBO might pick it up, that we can show titties. Holy shit, Bri, this is the ticket. I gotta email that to myself.
Pookie drove with one hand, thumbed his cell phone keys with the other. Brian's gaze nervously flicked between the road ahead and Pookie's phone.
Is there any point in me reminding you texting and driving is illegal?
No,
Pookie said. He hit the last button and put the phone back in his pocket.
Speaking of plot lines, Bri, any more of those dreams last night?
Brian paused, then shook his head.
LLWTL, Pookie said. Let me hear it. Similar to the first one?
Brian closed his eyes. The tangy taste of blood echoed on his tongue.
No, worse.
Talk to her, brother. What happened?
Not really sure,
Brian said. Then, in barely a breath,
I think I tore his arm off.
He couldn't bring himself to say what he really remembered. I bit his arm off, and it tasted better than anything I've ever known.
You tore his arm off,
Pookie said, nodding as if that was the most normal thing in the world.
Nice. And what did you do with said arm?
Brian closed his eyes, trying to crystallize his fuzzy dream memories.
I don't know. I woke up after that part. It was weird in another way, too.
How so?
I woke up sporting wood.
Pookie let out his sound.
That's new. I wake up with wood every day. Can't even pee in the toilet. It won't point down. Got a whiz in the shower. It's golden rainbows for all.
Thanks for sharing.
So you woke up with a rager. So what?
Brian chewed on his bottom lip.
Because I'm pretty sure I was turned on by the killing.
Had the first dream also aroused him? No, not that he could remember. But murdering the kid, all that hate mixed up with lust. Lust for pain. Lust for fear. Brian tried to push the thoughts away.
Was it in the same place?
Pookie said.
The dream, did you recognize the location?
Brian started to talk, then paused, remembering the red blanket at Fern Street. He'd seen it in his dream, and then impossibly found it in real life. What if there was something from last night's dream waiting for him? Something far worse than an abandoned red blanket with yellow duckies and brown bunnies? All it would take was one quick trip to set his mind at ease.
Post in Meacham Place,
Brian said.
Roger, Adam 12,
Pookie said,
See the man at Post and Meacham.
Pookie suddenly changed lanes for no reason, cutting off a Volkswagen as he headed for Post Street. Chapter 23. Brian's Dose of Reality.
Pookie eased the Buick to a stop. Meacham Place looked quiet, empty. Beyond the black gate, the alley seemed undisturbed. Bits of trash dotted the cracked pavement. On the alley's right side, four narrow trees stretched up, waiting for the brief window of time when the sun would be overhead and send light down between the two buildings. Brian stared at the abandoned one-story building on the alley's left. Paint and graffiti-covered boards covered the old laundromat's three arched windows. Across the alley from the urban ruin was a three-story narrow brick building, well-kept, neat as you please. Decay on one side of the street, finery on the other. Plenty of that to go around in San Francisco. At the bottom corner of the abandoned building, where the sidewalk turned under the black gate and into the alley, Brian saw the place where he had hidden under a hunter's blind, a blanket watching for the prey, the boy to walk past. Brian rolled down his window and smelled it, a scent, thick and rich, billowing out of the alley carried by a breeze that slid into his nose. It was the same odor that had made him dizzy up on the roof with Paul Maloney and Polyester Rich. The same, but also unique.
Pooks, you smell that?
He heard Pookie sniff.
Maybe? Smells like piss?
Piss, yes. Piss, but also something else. Brian looked to the four scraggly trees growing out of the narrow sidewalk. At the base of the farthest tree, wedged between the trunk and the building, a blanket, dark and rumpled.
Bri-Bri?
A blanket, covering something about the size of a man. A man, or a big teenage boy. No, it was a dream. Just a dream. His tongue tasted the memory of hot blood. His mouth salivated.
Hey, seriously,
Pookie said.
Are you okay?
Brian didn't answer. He got out of the car and walked to the black gate. He held the square bars the way a prisoner holds his jail cell door. The pointed tops of the bars were a good 3 feet above his head. In his dream, an effortless standing jump had carried him over this gate, but in the waking world he saw that would be impossible. The dark blanket looked wet. Wetness on the sidewalk. Streaks of it. Wetness on the brick wall, in lines and patterns, in symbols and words. He vaguely recognized these things, but only saw bits of them out of the corner of his eye. He could not look away from the blanket. The gate rattled as Brian climbed it. The sound of a car door shutting.
Brian! Answer me, man!
Brian dropped down on the other side. He walked toward the blanket. Behind him, the gate rattled again, followed by sound of big dress shoes hitting the pavement.
Brian, this is blood. It's everywhere.
Brian didn't answer. That scent. So overpowering.
It's on the walls, Pookie said. Jesus, I think they painted a picture in blood. Right on the fucking walls.
Brian reached for the blanket. His fingers clenched on fabric. Wet fabric. He yanked the blanket away. A ravaged corpse. Its right arm had been ripped off. A piece of collarbone jutted out from near the neck. The stomach had been cut to pieces, intestines dragged out, then shoved back in like dirt stuffed back into a hole. So much blood. And that face. Puffy and swollen. Missing eye. Shattered jaw. The boy's own mother wouldn't recognize him. But the hair. Brian recognized the hair. Black, curly, wiry. To the left of the body, a white baseball hat streaked with blood spatter.
Brian!
Pookie's voice again. Something in his tone forced Brian to turn. Pookie was staring at the mutilated body. He looked up at Brian, his expression one of disbelief, perhaps even shock.
Brian, how did you know about this?
Brian didn't have an answer. The smell of piss was so strong it made his head spin. Pookie's right hand moved a touch closer to the left flap of his sport coat.
Brian, did you do this?
Brian shook his head.
No. No way, man. You know I couldn't do something like this.
Pookie's eyes looked so cold. Was this the face Perp saw when he took them down? A happy-go-lucky man, unless you were in his sights. Then Pookie Chang became serious business.
Step out of the alley, Pookie said. Slowly. And keep your hands away from your gun.
Pooks, I'm telling you that I didn't.
You knew! How could you know?
That was the million-dollar question. If there was an answer, did Brian really want to know it?
I told you,
Brian said.
I had a dream.
Pookie took a breath, then nodded.
Right, a dream.
If you had knowingly done this for whatever reason, you wouldn't have told me about it. And you sure as hell wouldn't have brought me right to the body. But it doesn't change the fact that you knew.
Pooks, I...
Shut the fuck up, Brian! Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to believe my instincts and not my eyes. You're going to step out of this alley and stay out until I tell you to move. I'm going to call this in. We're going to gather evidence and see if anything points to you. Meantime, you don't say a word to anyone about your dreams or anything else. I'm going to wait and pray that my best friend, my partner, is not a fucking murderer.
Pookie suspected him? But Pookie knew Brian. Knew him better than anyone.
I'm not, Brian said. I'm not a murderer.
Pookie raised his eyebrows.
Yeah? Are you sure about that?
Brian opened his mouth to answer, but nothing came out. Because when it came down to it, he wasn't sure at all. Chapter 24. Pookie and his partner. Pookie Chang had seen a lot of nasty things in his day. He was no stranger to dead bodies. Back in Chicago, his second homicide case involved a man who had killed his mother, then tried to dispose of the body by chopping it into chunks small enough to fit into the kitchen sink's garbage disposal. You're never the same after you see something like that. It changes you. He'd handled cases that showed just how evil people could be, cases that made him doubt his faith. After all, how could a loving God allow things like this to happen? Yes, he had doubted God, doubted his own ability to do the job, and on more than one occasion he doubted the justice system itself. But in their 6 years of partnership, he had never doubted Brian Clouser. Not until now. Cops on the scene had cordoned off Meacham Place in just one of Post Street's three lanes, allowing the one-way morning traffic to continue along. Two SFPD cruisers were parked at the curb. Two more were parked on the sidewalk, one on either side of the alley. A half-dozen uniforms milled about, keeping people away, calmly instructing pedestrians to use the other side of the street. Bubble lights flashed blue and red. The morgue van sat silently, like a scavenger, waiting for the CSI personnel to finish their work before it could claim the corpse as its own. Pookie stood on the sidewalk outside the now-open black gate. He stayed close to Brian. Badges hung from both of their necks. Pookie stared into the alley, watching crime scene investigators Sammy Berzon and Jimmy Hung do their thing. They wore dark blue windbreaker jackets with SFPD in white across the back. What they found might nail Pookie's best friend to the wall, but the truth had to come out. Brian looked horrible, his green eyes and pale white skin a harsh contrast to his dark red beard. The guy seemed to be in shock, but this could not wait, could not be put off until he felt better.
"Tell me again," Pookie said.
He spoke quietly, loud enough only for Brian to hear.
"Where were you last night?"
Brian tilted his head closer, responded in kind.
"My apartment. I went straight there after Cheryl sent me home."
Pookie remembered Brian falling asleep on his desk. Brian, who'd never missed a day of work or even exhibited the slightest sniffle.
"You were sick yesterday," Pookie said. "Feel the same today?"
"Worse. The whole body hurts. I think I have a fever or something."
Pookie nodded. Could the fever be so bad that Brian somehow went out last night, during the dark hours the guy loved so much,